So this is the third talk in the course on Anatta. And I want to give it the title, Falling Apart, But Waking Up. And I want to start by saying, we can't ignore the question of selfing. We don't quite know how to grasp it. But just a reminder that there's no question that's been occupying human civilization for thousands and thousands of years. There's no question more consistent than who am I. So just to put it in perspective, and the Buddhist direction would explore who am I, not as an intellectual, philosophical concept, although there's nothing wrong with that and it can help us sometimes, but really to look at this question in a very practical way. So the question, who am I, can be like the big question of thousands of years, or it can be, what happens when someone cuts me off in the freeway? And I have a choice. You bastard, how you can do that? You cut me off in the freeway. Me. Attack. Defense. Ego. Or, oh, someone's gone there. One full of self, the other much less self. And that would be a more Buddhist attitude to looking at self. So, as I said before, our problem of looking at self is that because it seems everywhere and behind everything and behind thought and so on, it's difficult to meet it. So what we tend to do is work with issues that come up from the self or through the self. And the way the self is manifest in life, in events, in experiences, in pain and pleasure. And there we tend to watch the self manifesting, expressing itself in experience, and that way we can see it. I mean, pain of breaking up a relationship can be a big pain, and the self feels shattered and hurting. And eventually we can let go of that pain. It dissolves. And when it dissolves, some of that selfing goes as well. Some selfing is also gone. For example, and another example, we have a thought that's obsessive, it goes round and round, a loop in the mind. When that loop dissolves, it takes a bit of us with it. We are less me because we're not in the loop in the mind. So we look at self in these ways as it's manifest in experience, arising and disappearing and holding on to something and fighting something and then relaxing on something, all of that. That's how we meet. However, we do need a deeper practice in order to really see selfing more exactly, more clearly. And that's not about kind of getting ourselves better. Not about doing things better or cleaning the inner life, purifying our inner world so there's less disturbance and less problem and less suffering. It's not about psychological cleaning. It's somewhere deeper. And there's a nice image in the suttas of this. The Buddha said, you can wash the stains from a cloth. Now what they used to do then, I remember in Varanasi how they did it too. They used to use cow dung as soap. They used to use cow shit as soap. So they would wash the cloth with cow shit in the water. So the Buddha said, look, okay, you got rid of the stains, and you can call them psychological issues, problems, fears, conditions, conditionings, patterns, psychological patterns, washing, 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 all the retreats we did, all the psychologists we went to. But there's left the smell of cow shit. And that's the whole cloth. So you need to go somewhere deeper in order to do the final cleaning, which is to clean the smell of the cow dung. And one way to do it is to see that the self is not a thing, is not one thing. Like I said, it's not a noun, it's a verb. It's a flow. And we can see it, you know, if we take a quick look at my hand, if I take a quick look at my hand, I see a thing, a hand. But a deeper look, a more focused, careful, mindful, attentive look, will see the hand as a verb, as full of dynamic living experiences that change all the time. Touch, movement, energy, flow. The whole body is what is flowing with energy. So it's no longer a body. A body is a quick look, hand. We're not talking about quick look. Going deeper, we see everything is made of flow and change. And there's no one thing anywhere. It's all made of everything else. Thought. We usually make a summary of our thought. Some kind of summary. Stream of consciousness, all about trouble I have at work. All going around and around and around. I'm just thinking nothing else about the trouble I have with my boss at work and what a drag it is and how I have to change my job and how it doesn't work. But if we look at that stream of consciousness, at thought itself, we see it's made up of tiny little packages, each one saying something a bit different, each one following the one before, each one in chains because of what came before, then what comes after. The rebirth, if you like, of the next thought coming from the death of the previous thought. And if we look that carefully, we see that everything, a thought, a stream of consciousness that we usually just make a summary out of it, the stream of consciousness is made of flow and packages and elements and bubbles. And it's really important because, I mean, for example, in the peace work we did for so many years, Israeli-Palestinian, a Palestinian seen without any mindful awareness or heartfulness or penetration or clarity will just be a Palestinian, or a black skin, white skin, or a foreigner, or some label. That's like looking at the hand. A quick view, no insight. But the minute you get close to this person, this Palestinian boy, you begin to unpack his huge life and his needs and his pains and his world and his desires and his dreams and his images and what he feels about his life and what he thinks about you. And all of a sudden, this person is a huge universe, no longer Palestinian or Israeli, the other side. So we need to break up illusion by breaking up experience into moments, into mindful awareness that it's made of many things. We are so many selves, each of us. So we might think, oh, I'm grandfather. That label, grandfather, is such a tiny little label from all the thousands of other labels that we have for ourselves. I'm this, I'm that, I'm this age, endless labels we give ourselves, endless roles we have. Grandfather is like, just one small blip on the screen. A doer, a lover, a healthy person, a sick person, a tall person, a short person, an old person, a young person, happy person, unhappy person. It just goes on and on and on and on. We can never define ourselves at all. So the way to work with, in a way, with self is to break it up. And then we're closer to the truth of it. Just like we break up this thing called body into a flow of experience. So there's a nice text I want to read, a Buddhist text called the lute, or the guitar. Suppose there was a king who had never heard the sound of a lute before. He might hear the sound of the lute and say, "Oh, that sound is delightful. It's so intoxicating. It's so beautiful." And his court would say, "That, sir, is called a lute that is making such a beautiful sound." And he would say, "Go and fetch that lute." And they would fetch the lute and say, "Here it is, the lute whose sound is so delightful, intoxicating." And he would say, "Enough of your lute. Fetch me the sound." And they would say, "This lute, sir, is made of many, many components. It's through the activity of many, many components that it sounds, depending on the body of it, the skin of it, the neck, the frame, the strings, the bridge, and the person that's playing it and the effort he's making. And so this lute, made of so many pieces, sounds through the activity of numerous components." And then the king would get angry. And he would split the lute into 10 pieces, 100 pieces. And having split the lute into 100 pieces, he would shave it to little splinters. And then he would burn it in a fire. And having burnt it in a fire, he would reduce it to ashes. And having reduced it to ashes, he would throw it before a high wind, or let it wash away by a swift flowing stream. And he would say to them, "This is a sorry thing, this lute, whatever a lute may be, by which people have been so thoroughly tricked for so long. And in the same way, when you investigate form, feelings, in other words, experience, consciousness, then thoughts of me or mine or I am don't appear anymore." So it's worth thinking about that. I mean, right now, at this moment, there is an agreement. And the agreement is you're listening to me and you put me here. I'm here with your permission. And you call me, at this minute, the teacher. Where is that? Where is that agreement? It's just a thought shared by everybody. It's just a thought that comes and goes. It's like a lute. It doesn't really exist. But I'm here and I'm teaching and I kind of take on that role and we're all agreed that that's what's happening right now. But it doesn't really have any substance. There is no person here, really. There is no role. It's just an agreement that I'm a teacher right now and that's what I'm doing. There is a nice little Theravada Buddhist story about two monks that were in the forest. And a beautiful woman came rushing by and ran away. And after her came a man said, "Have you seen a beautiful woman come rushing by here? I want to catch her." And one monk said, "No, no beautiful woman has come this way." So the man went away. And the other monk said, "You broke the monk's rules. You lied. This is not right speech. How can you do that?" He said, "No, I didn't lie. I didn't see a woman rushing by. I just saw teeth rushing by." Conditions change and everything changes. Everything changes to something else, making conditions to something else. And we are made of many, many elements which are constantly changing. And we are reborn into this moment again and again and again. We are a bunch of conditions. Again and again. There's another small dialogue that I like very much about this. Mara, who is the devil of the Buddhist text. And by the way, Mara visited the Buddha all his life. So Mara doesn't disappear. And you call Mara the ordinary mind. Just the mind of an ordinary mind that is not special and keeps questioning the spiritual life. So Mara comes to this woman and says, "Who created you? Where is the maker of a human being? Where has the living being originated? And where does it end?" And the sister, the female nun, said, "Mara, what? Do you assume a being? Do you take such a position? This being is a pile of constructions and pieces. Here, no living being can be pinned down. Just as when, with a collection of parts, we use the word car, chariot. It's a collection of parts, that's all. And so when all the pieces are there, we have a convention of saying there's a being." And Mara then disappears and said, "Oh, Vajra the nun knows me." So what are the pieces? I want to look at that a little bit. And I must say for myself, when I heard this teaching first, I mean, over the years, I've been hearing it again and again and again, from the beginning of my meeting with Dharma, with Buddhist teaching. And I thought it was kind of abstract. It was a bit like brain science, the Buddhist brain science. But, you know, you can't avoid it. You all maybe know about the Heart Sutta. The Heart Sutta is probably the most famous sutta in the whole Buddhist canon. And the Heart Sutta, form is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness is nothing other than form. But it also goes through five aspects of an experience, which you can say, "I don't really need to know that. I don't have to know that." And it's true. But it's quite interesting to actually, you know, do a V and say, "I understand something about the way an experience is broken up into its elements." Because there is a deeper truth of what really is happening under the sense of a human being or a hand or a something. So this teaching is more or less the earliest teaching of the Buddha, by the way. And it is a bit like brain science. When the brain scientist, neuroscience, would say, "What's an experience?" Well, it is involved in this part of the brain and that part of the brain, and it's the amygdala, and it's the the cortex, and that does this bit and that does that bit. And then you look, and the brain science will say, all the brain is kind of put together pieces. And then you have an experience, and we don't know that the brain is doing that. So the word that is used in English is aggregates, but I like the translation paraphernalia, bits and pieces. The original Sanskrit means piles, piles, piles of stuff, piles. And these piles make up our experience. So there's five of them, and the first is namarupa, meaning form. Form. There is form in the world. There is world, there is stuff and elements. Earth, fire, air, water, molecules. But they're not separate from being seen, because they're only there when we know that they're there. There is mind and matter together. So nama rupa is mind and matter. Rupa is form or matter, and nama is the way we name it, we know it. So the knowing and the elements are always together. The world and us, you could say, is the first element, or the first of the aggregates. And we are made of the world. The two are together. And that's the first of the piles, or the bits and pieces, namarupa. The second is perception. It's the way we grasp something in order to know it. The way we perceive something. The way we catch and find meaning in. The way we know. It's the senses. It's spontaneous. And we can practice with perception, and we're doing it here in the retreat, by going a bit behind perception into the senses. So if we look at the senses, we're actually cutting through perception into a kind of immediate, spontaneous, almost timeless, fresh moment, which is a moment of awareness. So it takes away the power or the control of perception and makes perception a bit of a kind of a cloud. It's not really needed all the time. Namarupa we can practice, by the way, the first aggregate. When we, very simply, if we ask, what is an object? We really don't know what this thing is. Everyone here in this room is going to look at this object in a different way, have a different thought about it, have a different way of looking at it. Now it's like this, now it's like that. This object is not really an object, it's a relationship. And if we really understand that, then the world is not full of objects. Namarupa. It's more like bubbles. It's more like just dynamic experiences of the world. And we can practice with that. We can go, when we're outside walking meditation, do we know this tree? What do we see in a tree? How much of the tree? What side of it? Now this way, now that way. Then we move our head a little bit and the tree is different and we are different. So what's a tree? That's practicing with Namarupa. Vedana is the third. It's the pleasant, unpleasant, the pushing and the pulling. And usually we build Vedana, the liking, not liking, into a story, into a narrative. This is good for me. This I want more of. This I want less of. It leads to craving. But it's quite an easy place to look at. Yeah. Lunch, pulling me. The bell rings, I'm off to lunch. Something in us knows lunch. It's not a question, it's not a problem, it's not an issue, but still, if we look carefully, it's a pull, it's a thought, it's an attraction, it's a direction, our whole body's going there, We don't go in the opposite direction. How many of us, when we ring the bell for lunch, goes in the opposite direction? Especially with the lunch here, it's so good. So it's quite an easy place to work, the Vedana, because we really can see it quite clearly. Push pull, all the time. Push pull, things are all the time. Attractive, not attractive, pleasant, unpleasant. The fourth is sankhara, which are patterns, tendencies, memory, shape, the shape of our experience. Like I talked yesterday about the shape of an olive tree. Well, what about the shape of us? The constructions that we make inside, the learning that we do called me and the world. Self is a kind of a sankhara, is a construction. We construct yourself and we give it a name and a label and a solidity and a belief. And the way to work with sankhara is just undo the belief in it. So yes, we have a shape, but it's not that interesting. We know something, but it's not really a fact. There's a knowing going on. But who can say it's a fact? That's already a belief, a construction. I mean, look at a football match. A football match, the whole kind of huge event with loads and loads of people and the ball going and people running about and like a huge construction, and we can say, yeah, it's a football match, one thing. But of course, the minute we kind of look at it a bit more carefully, it's not one thing at all. It's endless kind of activity going in all kinds of directions, people buzzing around like bees. So not seeing things as facts and constructions, even memory, is the way we work with sankhara. It brings more wisdom, awareness, instead of immediate conclusions, this is that, but this is that, and that is the way it is. The fifth of the aggregates, or the bits and pieces, or the piles, is consciousness. And indeed, it's more subtle, but it is the way that something is known. So we're not used to looking at consciousness. We're used to looking at objects. But we don't know an object unless there's consciousness that is knowing it. So it is not so difficult to actually see the knowing, touch the knowing, sense the knowing. The knowing is happening. The knowing is reaching out and knowing an object. The knower is knowing the object. All of you are watching this object. The only way you can do that is a knowing that is reaching out and grasping the object. But what's happening between you and the object? Forget the object and forget you for a minute. What's joining you and the object? It's the knowing. It's like fills the space. So consciousness is like the white paper. There's many images in the spiritual life tradition, is the white paper on which there is writing. It's the like the screen on which the movie of experience is projected. It's the kind of base of knowing. And this too, we can experience it, we can explore it. So all these five elements, aggregates, bits and pieces, we can begin to experience inside an experience of a bell, a tree, a hand, and see them as being rather like clouds or bubbles. They come together, they make an experience, and then they go to pieces again. They come together, they make an experience, and they go to pieces again. If we can touch that even a tiny little bit, it's very liberating, because it takes away the belief in me and in things and in a fixed, frozen world. So that's the power of the aggregates. That's why the Heart Sutra is so clear. Form is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness, nothing other than form. Feeling is nothing. Nothing is emptiness, and emptiness is feeling. Perception is nothing other than empty, and emptiness is perception. Go through the whole five. And the only thing that holds the whole lot together to make an illusion of a person, a thing, a hand, an object, stuck, finished, done, closed, closed box, is attachment. And there we come back to the second noble truth of the Buddha. It's our attachment to things, to boxes, that makes us collect together all these bits and pieces of experience and just call it a thing, a hand, a person, a teacher, a thought. So, of course, it's not so easy, and it can be harder. If we have difficult experiences, then we really feel, I can't deal with looking at a difficult experience as a whole bunch of pieces. My back is hurting. How can I look at it as a whole bunch of pieces? My back is hurting. I want it to shut up. I want it to stop. I don't like it. So that clinging or craving or need kind of wipes out the freedom that we have to look at things more carefully. But we still can do it, even a bit. And we can look at our back that's hurting and begin to take it to pieces. What are you made of, my back that's hurting? What is the elements of it? Yes, there is form, there is a body, there is tissues and cells, there is perception of it, there is feeling that I don't like it, there is sankhara or memory, history, it's doing things to me, it's got its voices, it's telling me things, I'm going round with it, it's got consciousness in it, because I know it. So we can do it with a pain, but it's more difficult with a painful experience, because it kind of presses our buttons. But we can go out in the street and just begin to feel things are made of uncounted experiences. We see someone, we see a dog passing by in the street, and this dog is, do we really know what this dog is? The dog is made of aggregates, of pieces. So the dog has got his fur, and it's got his form, it's got his thoughts, it's got it. That's passing by, just a dog. No, it's not just a dog. It's a walking mass of of aggregates, of pieces, of elements, of consciousness, of dogness, of memory, dog memory, of interest, of wanting, and where's the next meal coming from, you know? So we need to keep watching it and challenging this sense of, I would say, minimal view of who I am. The minimal view. So I am Palestinian, I am Israeli, I am British, I am a grandfather, is just the minimal view. If we stop there, we're stuck. Doesn't help us. But as soon as we open the truth of this, this grandfather is made of so many conditions and so much change and so dynamic, and every minute is reborn. So who's a grandfather? And where is that grandfather? Or where is that person? Or where is that British? So it's not wrong to say, here's a grandfather, but it's just very limited. And therefore, we actually, it's not helpful to say also, I am not a grandfather. Because it's also not true. It's just limited. So something it is important to get close to selfing isn't about saying no self. Because there is a grandfather here. It's not a kind of completely, it's not a lie. It's not, there's, you know, there's grandfathering happening along with 10 million other kinds of person that is this thing. So we don't want to say I am, we don't want to say I am not. And there's a beautiful text that, you know, all the Dharma teachers that I ever met really put this text right up there as a kind of key text about this. And it's when a practitioner came to the Buddha and said, look, I can't anymore. You have to tell me, is there a self or is there not a self? I need an answer. I can't keep going like this. I need an answer. Is there a self or is there not a self? And frustratingly, the Buddha was utterly silent and he didn't answer. And so the practitioner, the spiritual explorer, Bhatchagota, went off, frustrated. And so the monks asked the Buddha, look, why didn't you answer him? And the Buddha said, there's many things that need an answer of silence. Because if I would have said, there is a self, it would have confirmed a view, and more than a view, a kind of a whole approach to life, of determinism, of there is things and there is a self and I am this, and it would have confirmed and constructed a kind of a way of looking at reality which is not right. And if I said there's no self, it would have done the same thing but in the opposite direction. It would have confirmed nihilism, it would have confirmed there's nothingness, and it would have gone in another direction also. An error, a mistake. So it's better, with a question like that, to stay silent, but to look intensely. What is this person? In the second talk of the Buddha, I think it's the second talk after his awakening, he explained the aggregates, the five aggregates, the piles. And he said that many times after this second talk. And what he said, there's basically two things, I want to summarize it in just two sentences. Again and again and again, the Buddha said, if everything changes, how can there be an enduring self? The only thing that makes an apparent self is our clinging, our craving, our holding on. How can there be an enduring self if the whole universe is nothing but change? And the other kind of comment he made in this sutta, in this talk, was if selfing brings so much pain and struggle and difficulty to our life, who needs it? Who needs it? Who wants it? So look. Look at it.
Maybe you don't need as much self as you think.
So how does it affect us? What do we need to do? Again, I think our basic practice, basic mindfulness, basic vipassana, basic awareness practice, in a way does the job, because it shows us repeatedly again and again that everything is radically changing, that everything is moving. And when we get up from a sitting or we get up from having a cup of tea, the world has changed. Our problem is we don't notice that. When we go from one thought to the next, the world has changed. When we walk out of this room, the world is different. We are different. We don't notice it because you make a sort of continuous stream. We make a continuous summary. So we don't notice that everything's changed. But if we actually look at the three characteristics, as I was talking about yesterday, we can check out these things. We can look at these things. Is a label real? What is our assumptions? What is an assumption? Who am I as a comment, label, thought about me? Is it real? That's all part of vipassana. Voices in the mind, are they real? Let's have a look at them. This is not kind of beyond, but it's certainly the core of helping us to kind of take this assumption of self to pieces. So we need to let go constantly of our kind of belief in things. A disturbing thought, look at it, see it, really see it. What's it made of? Is anyone in charge of this disturbing thought? Is it really mine? Or is it come from life? How am I holding on to it? What am I doing with it? What do I build out of it? What is it doing? This is basic vipassana, but what we can do is once we see more clearly the kind of dynamic flowing nature of reality, moment by moment, it must begin to challenge this belief in my self-existence. It will do it. And then all the other teachings on self will make a lot more sense because we'll have more experience, including the aggregates. So I think that's all for now. Thank you.